Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Be Bold America is a live bi-weekly talk show for those who are motivated to step out with the bold actions necessary to reunite this country, fight for democracy, and learn what they can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to return to our democratic republic. Our future depends on it. Our program today is the Second World War in our future? Joe Biden is now president-elect and working on repairing democracy. So Joe Biden's got the most votes as president-elect, yet there were 70 million people who voted against him. What were those 70 million Americans voting for? What do they want? I've heard several times they're afraid of Democrats and the Democratic presidency. Why? What are their unresolved feelings? One of my favorite quotes is, "Unresolved feelings never die. They just come forth later in uglier ways." Will uglier ways come forth in America? We have big things to do. Our special guest today is Dr. Ronnie Lipschutz. More than 25 years ago, Dr. Ronnie Lipschutz studied and wrote about cultural conflict and the potential for civil violence in America. He taught politics for 30 years at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He retired this past July and is now Professor Emeritus of Politics. Today, Dr. Lipschutz is co-director of the Sustainable Systems Research Foundation Santa Cruz and is host of Sustainability Now right here on KSQD every other Sunday at 5 p.m., alternating with Be Bold America. Welcome back to Be Bold America, Ronnie. It is such a pleasure to have you on the program again.
And it's a pleasure for me to be here, Jill. Although I want to make one correction. We're not going to talk about World War. We're going to talk about Civil War.
Oh, I keep doing that. Thank you for that correction. Civil War. Good grief. So let's get started. We'll take a deep breath. And we now have the benefit of five post-election days to see how the public is acting and reacting in response to the presidential election results. Here is the question for today, and I'll get it right. Is there a second civil war in our future?
So you want me to start responding to that?
Yes, of course.
Okay. Well, so there was a lot of speculation prior to the election that, about how both sides might respond if their candidate were to lose, and the media was full of articles and columns, which I read very carefully, about the possibility of a civil war or a coup or some other form of organized violence in the streets. And so far it hasn't happened, which I suppose is a really good thing. But then, of course, the game is not over, right? There's still counting and litigating going on, and we might expect that some people might get upset because of the outcomes. So it still seems relevant to me to ask how we got to where we are today, a deeply divided society in which red and blue hold incompatible worldviews about how life is to be lived in modern times.
And what are those incompatible views?
Well, you know, it would seem that these go much deeper than what we like to think about as truths and facts. They're really worldviews. And their worldviews about how people understand living in the world and the extent to which they feel they have control over their lives or not. And I would say that on the left, there is more a sense of we're rational, whether that's true or not. We're in control of our lives. We have free will. We can act to change the way things are, especially if we do so with wisdom. And on the right, there's a kind of a perspective which is, I think, much more fatalistic. It's that, the world is given to us. Maybe God has a hand in it, maybe not. And that world is structured in particular ways. It imposes an order on us that we need to keep in order to keep things in order. And if we somehow violate those by making free choices and exercising free will, disorder is likely to follow. And that won't be good for anybody.
Well, Charles Blow, in support of what you're talking about, wrote in the New York Times recently an op-ed titled, "America's Most Dangerous Weeks Are Still Ahead of Us." It concluded by saying Trump has signaled in every way possible that he plans to stay in power at any cost. How do Republicans read that signal then, based on the worldview you just explained?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting, excuse me, in the sense that, well, I was listening to another NPR station earlier today, and someone was interviewed who said, you know, there is no way that this election can turn out the way, you know, it's being claimed, that there was all kinds of cheating and illegalities going on in terms of which votes were counted. And I can't accept Joseph Biden as my president. And, of course, Donald Trump hasn't conceded, and he still seems to be raising the notion that the legitimacy of this election remains in doubt. And, of course, he can give a signal to his followers that this illegitimacy that he claims needs to be supported by the people, by his people. And we don't know whether he'll do that or not. We know that he tends to be kind of, you know, ad hoc and say things off the cuff and not think very carefully about what he's saying, although maybe he is thinking very carefully. So we don't really know what will come out of the White House. And I think that's of concern.
Well, we don't know what's going to come out of the White House, but if these signals continue that he's not going to concede, that staying in power is more important than anything, then what's your idea of what the Republicans will do in reading that signal?
Well, you know, I want to say something that I don't think I'm less convinced that Donald Trump wants to remain in power than Donald Trump does not want to be declared a loser.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
That he wants to be able to exit and say, well, you know, in spite of everything, I really won. The way he did in 2016 with the popular vote, right? So he can leave office being a winner, at least in his own eyes and in the eyes of his supporters. And, you know, that's fairly, I mean, if he wants to claim that he's the winner, well, you know, why not let him do it? We will know that wasn't the case. But if in his attempts to be the winner, he does start to stir up some of his followers, and, you know, his followers have lots of guns, and we've seen certain kinds of activities that give rise to concern about what they might do. Let me be blunt. If he says, you know, it's time to go into the cities and do damage or something like that, then people are liable to do what he says. They've set him up as an authority figure, and you don't defy an authority figure.
Well, one thing we know that his father taught him, that there aren't winners and losers. There are losers and killers. His father taught him that, said it over and over again. So the idea of being a loser and how he used the phrase losers and suckers for our military professionals, that it is a big issue for him. And I don't know how he can save face and leave the office without being considered a loser.
Well, certainly the 74 million who voted for Biden will consider him a loser, right? But mm-hmm. again, if he maintains this position until January 20th, that the election was stolen, that he was the legitimate winner, you know, as I said, he can exit Washington, the White House, and say, well, all else being equal, I'm still the winner, right? And he can also sit on the sidelines and snipe at the Biden administration, at the Biden-Harris administration, and say, well, you know, whatever they do is not legitimate because they didn't win. He can call it a coup. I mean, he can do all kinds of things. And the question again is, will he be able to stir up his followers? Mm-hmm. And I actually don't know if that's possible or not. And again, as I said, although there are protests going on, and you know, I imagine there are a lot of unhappy people out there, we don't really see much in the way of people going out in the streets and engaging in any kind of violence, which, to be quite honest, surprises me. I was really expecting the worst, and I don't think we've seen the worst. But as we said, as you said at the beginning, well, you didn't say at the beginning, right? You said take a deep breath. Mm-hmm. Well, it could get worse mm-hmm. before it gets better.
And as Charles Blow said, America's most dangerous weeks are still ahead of us. Mm-hmm. And also, if he leaves thinking he's a winner, or defining that he's been, he didn't lose, it seems that that message undermines the current administration and fosters how the 70 million American thinks that Joseph Biden is not the president of the United States.
Well, Jill, let's face it, after 2016, how many of us were willing to accept Donald Trump as our president?
We weren't willing to accept it, but we don't have all the guns.
No, that's true.
It's not
that's
in true. Our psyche to go out there and create violence over it, but we have seen... actually, even the FBI director said there's more of a threat of domestic terrorism from right-wing groups in this country. So that's of concern to me.
Yeah, and I've thought that was a possibility now for at least 30 years, and probably longer. But the militia movement emerged in the 1990s, in an organized form, and that was already sort of a precursor to what we see today. So this is nothing new. I mean, that's one thing that's important to emphasize, that these kinds of concerns are in no way new. The issue has always been, how organized might the right get and what might trigger, we'll call it an uprising or an insurrection or whatever you want. What would get them out into the streets? Now, they're also, I'm sure, well aware that if they start to engage in these kinds of activities, there will be a clampdown. It won't be just given free hand in the cities to do what they wish. There's a certain amount of caution, I think, that will probably be exercised by these groups and these militias. But again, as I always told my students, my predictive abilities are terrible. So don't believe anything that I say. Just keep it in mind.
Hi, Ronnie. This is Howard.
Hey, Feltzman. Howard.
Hi. And if listeners are just tuning in, this is KSQD, KSQD. In listening to the two of you, I've been very relieved also that there hasn't been violence or, a real... I just don't feel as afraid as I might have. And to me, a really significant reason for that is that Fox News is no longer supportive of Donald Trump's presidency and is no longer essentially a state-run media. Now, I know Trump has his followers who are come hell or high water diehards, and he's got the direct line to them through tweeting and social media, but I think it would be a game changer if the tens and tens of millions of people who watch Fox News were getting egged on that way.
Well, you remember the Wall Street Journal, which has a firewall between its editorial office and its news reporting. Now, I'm not saying the Wall Street Journal is somehow unbiased, in terms of left and right, but they tend to try and keep the editorial voice separate. And it may well be that on Fox that the news reporters decided, they had to, they couldn't appear to be too biased. But you've still got Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham and all of those other trolls with their shows, and they're certainly not going to moderate their rhetoric.
Well, one thing that other journalistic organizations have is they have a standards and ethics department. Interestingly enough, Fox News does not have a standards and ethics department. And I think that is of concern, that's for sure. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online from the KSQD.org homepage or catch up on previous shows by visiting the KSQD Be Bold America webpage or subscribe to your podcast on your favorite podcast platform. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
And this is listener-supported KSQD. KSQD thanks the following recent donors who support our wonderful programs. They include Kenny Rogers, Susan Goldstein, Judy from Columbus, a Dr. Dawn listener, Nicholas Bischoff, Deb Molina, and Scott Sokol. They're among the best, the several, many listeners who inspire us to give you our very best here at 90.7 FM. May you also inspire others to donate to our website, ksqd.org. Jill?
Today our topic is the Second Civil War in our future? We're speaking with Dr. Ronnie Lipschutz, author and University of California, Santa Cruz, Professor Emeritus of Politics, and co-founder of the Sustainable Systems Research Foundation in Santa Cruz. I'm your host, Jill Cody. So, Ronnie, one thing also is that, as I mentioned, the FBI director said that domestic terrorism, there's more of a threat with right-wing groups, yet the Republicans keep putting Antifa out there as equal to the right wings. And what's interesting to me is that Antifa is short for anti-fascist. So I would think that the Republicans would be anti-fascist as well. But what are your thoughts? We've even, you know, they've demonized Antifa as if they were an equal group, and yet they have no organizational structure or a location of operations or any, structure of operation.
Well, any movement that is organized around the demonization of other parts of the society need an enemy, right? And sometimes that enemy is a particular group of people, and sometimes it's imaginary. I mean, if you go back to the Cold War and Joe McCarthy, there were Reds under everyone's beds. Was that the case? Probably not. I never found one. And in this case, you know, Antifa is in some ways a self-defined movement, but at the same, as you point out, it's not an organized movement. It's a tendency more than anything else. But it's a sort of the question is why should the Republicans be concerned if there is no threat? There are lots of, you know, this gets back to the question of how did we get into this situation. Maybe I should say a few words about that.
Sure, please.
You know, and I wanted to start with the example of the demise of Yugoslavia as a kind of a model that got me to really thinking about this. For those of you who may or may not remember, Yugoslavia was a communist country in the Balkans. And in the 1980s, as it was becoming more and more integrated into the global economy, it was experiencing globalization, it also started to experience more internal economic differentiation among its constituent ethnic republics. And the dominant group, the Serbians, started to feel resentment towards these other groups. And out of this emerged a fellow named Slobodan Milosevic, who, when he ran for office, when Yugoslavia started to have free elections, he ran not on a communist platform, but he ran on a nationalist platform. And it was a platform that basically identified the other ethnic groups in Yugoslavia as threats and enemies. And, you know, it's kind of uncanny how closely Donald Trump has followed that particular model. And it's, you know, part of this has to do with the way in which globalization, and that includes things like immigration and the multiculturalism of the society, have made the dominant group, that is to say whites, fearful of their dominance and of their status. And it's the same kind of process, and we've seen this in many, many countries. It's happening now in Hungary. It's happened to some degree in the UK. There are other places as well that we live in nation states. They're basically dominated by a single ethnic or national group, and when that group starts to see its hold on power and wealth start to slip away or to think that it's slipping away, they tend to strike back. And this is in democracies. This is not just in authoritarian societies. This is very much characteristic, it seems, of democracies as well.
Well, I would think Donald Trump's election in 2016 was a strike back.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and you know, Donald Trump gave voice, I think, to the kinds of resentments that had been building up and had been identified. You know, people had identified that when we talk about, you know, California as no longer being a majority ethnic, right? What does that mean for those who imagine themselves to be dominant in the society and to benefit from that dominance as well? We seem to have adjusted to it by becoming all Democrats, but not every place has done that, right? And so, and when you know, when people in the Midwest start seeing signs in a language that they don't understand and can't read, you know, billboards or something like that, they say, you know, what does this mean? Is this some other group that's becoming more and more prominent? And why are they doing that? And I'm not justifying that kind of, you know, response and resentment, but I think it's quite a common phenomenon. And, you know, we live in a democracy where you have this notion of majority rule, and the majority is a dominant nationality or ethnicity. And that starts to appear, whether it's true or not, threatened. Then people from that dominant group start to feel insecure. And Donald Trump, when he talked about illegal ballots in 2016, you know, from California, and imputed that those were by immigrants who were not citizens. You know, he was playing that particular card.
So, Ronnie, and you can let me know what your thoughts are too, is that resentment and fear of declining status would also lead to people believing in conspiracy theories. Vanity Fair article by Jeff Charlotte called Darkness Visible. What might have written off as Trump is madness, the conspiracy of QAnon is seeping into every corner of America's mind, and the danger is real. So here, now we've got this resentment and fear of declining status, people being susceptible to conspiracy theories, one of which is QAnon, which is growing, and now we have Congress members that adhere to this theory. So your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, again, my thoughts on that is that that conspiracy theories are everywhere, and it arises from people's feelings of insecurity and that they're not in control of their lives, and that surely there is a force somewhere that is doing this to them. In religious terms, God does good things and the devil does bad things, and if bad things happen to you, right, it's because the devil has done it, because Satan has somehow conspired against you. And so what we see here is the transfer of that particular perspective, which, you know, is not that old, I suspect, into political life. But the notion of global conspiracies is a pretty old one, right? There's the elders of Zion,
right?
The international bankers, what was it, the Trilateral Commission, you know, and even the Democratic Transition, what was the Democratic Transition Group, the one that was accused of plotting a coup in the summer? I can't remember the name of it, but this idea that we don't control our lives, so somebody somewhere must be doing this to us. I think the QAnon conspiracy theory is really, really off the wall. I read this morning that there are pedophiles and cannibals in the government, and I hadn't heard about the cannibalism before.
Oh boy, it keeps growing,
right? But you know, to invoke another historical parallel, when Germany lost World War I, the idea of the stab in the back became very common. This is why Germany lost, and the stab in the back was the result of a conspiracy of socialists and Jews and enemies of Germany. And they had essentially overthrown the Reich and the Kaiser and caused Germany to lose the war. You know, and in many ways, again, I keep looking at Weimar, the Weimar Republic of Germany in the 1920s, you know, because there is, of course, it ended up in Nazism. And someone once said that when people disagree, every argument usually ends up invoking the Nazis. And I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do that. But you know, there are some interesting parallels. There are also some incredible differences between that. But conspiracies really are explanations for why you're not controlling, you know, why your life seems out of control.
And in this case, I can invoke the Russians then. I mean, there's a force somewhere that's doing it. And to me, it could be a Russian bot. They think it's some anonymous person deep inside the federal government who's telling it what it is, working with Donald Trump to do in the deep state, whatever that is. And yet it could be a Russian bot that's created a Facebook page that talks, puts this out. And I envision, you know, a Russian hacker room somewhere where they're laughing at America at how they've manipulated so many people with this QAnon, unbelievable things that Democrats drink the blood of children. I mean,
well, that's the old, you know, Jewish libel.
Yes,
that Jews you know, take the blood of Christian children to make matzah for Passover. Right. Well, there is a continuity between all of these sort of vast conspiracy theories, and people who think about conspiracies are really unimaginative, you know, because they keep coming back to the same damn thing, that somebody's controlling the world. But I wanted to say that I'm not sure that the Russian case is quite the same as what QAnon seems to be disseminating, because we know, I think we know, that there are Russian hackers, that they have been, you know, doing this on various social media. The as far as I know, the evidence is pretty compelling.
That's why I make the comparison.
Right, but wait, but you know, what is the evidence that there are pedophiles and cannibals in the government, in the deep state, or someplace in one of the bureaucracies? You know, this is the thing about conspiracies. There are conspiracies, but it's so difficult to keep them truly secret, because people talk, conspiracies leak. This is why the lone terrorist, the lone wolf, is so terrorizing to people in the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, because there's no way, maybe except social media, to know what these people are thinking or planning to do.
To know about them.
Yeah, but as soon as you have two people, someone's bound to talk. So conspiracies, real conspiracies, are difficult to sustain. You know, Watergate is a great example. Was that a conspiracy? It was really ineptitude, but it leaked like a sieve. And,
people, you know, and blab.
So, yeah. People. So, you know, and the thing is that nobody, as far as I know, from inside the deep state has come out to blab or confess. Nobody who is credible. So it's hard to imagine that this such a conspiracy exists, because there's no leakage.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Our topic is a second civil war in our future? And we're speaking with Dr. Ronnie Lipschutz, UCSC Professor Emeritus of Politics and host of Sustainability Now, right here on KSQD biweekly on Sundays at 5 p.m.
And tomorrow at 5 p.m. Monday, we bring you Talk of the Bay here on KSQD. As 2020 winds down, we approach the minefield of holidays with the family. If you're following public health recommendations, the holidays this year will be different than you've ever experienced. Fewer people will fly to be with others, and there will be fewer and smaller family gatherings. This may sound like a bummer of a holiday season, but we're here to help. Tomorrow on Talk of the Bay, your host is Susie Westling, and her guests will offer tips on cooking your first turkey, making small gatherings more special, and connecting more meaningfully over distances. Terrified that your nuclear family will just brush off Thanksgiving? Dreading another one of those chaotic Zoom calls where everybody talks over everybody else and nothing gets said? Join us for some tips and tricks from the pros. That's Talk of the Bay tomorrow, Monday, from 5 to 6, here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. Many voices, one station.
Now, back to our bold and impressive guest, Dr. Ronnie Lipschutz. Ronnie, what are the politics of self-interest versus politics of group identity in a democratic republic, like the United States?
So, One of the great myths of our society, and maybe it's a necessary myth, is that we as individuals can recognize our self-interests and pursue them. And in elections, in election campaigns, this takes the form of what's called the rational voter, that the voter listens to the policy promises of competing candidates, tries to evaluate what those policies mean for the voter, and then makes a decision accordingly. So, is Joe Biden offering me better health care compared to Donald Trump, right? And I need better health care, so I will vote for Joe Biden. And that's the politics of interest. And it comes out of the rational choice theory in economics. And we don't have to go and talk about that. But it turns out that voters are not necessarily rational. The polls were wrong once again, and nobody is able to explain it except by saying maybe some of the people who supported Trump were reluctant to tell pollsters that they were going to do so. It's called a shy Trump voter. I actually recalled the other night, Jill, that after Nixon left office, you couldn't find anybody who had voted for him in 1972. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Yes, no one had supported him. So this is sort of the equivalent, right? And even people who recognize or acknowledge that maybe Trump isn't in their self-interest, nonetheless have other kinds of beliefs and elements of their worldview that they consider to be as important. And a lot of those have to do with identity. Religion is one element of identity that really, when you subject it to a kind of rational economic analysis, does not play out very well. But people often vote on the basis of not necessarily specific beliefs, but on the basis of a general feeling that this guy is going to be better for me than the other guy. And of course, Trump was very contradictory in this sense, since he violated all of the norms of every religion we can think of. But still, people said, well, and of course, that's a form of rationality, I suppose, but it's not a calculable rationality. And so we should sort of try and be aware of that polls rest on the proposition that people will tell the truth.
Well, what's interesting of the concept of a shy voter, to me, tells me that they know that voting for Donald Trump is wrong, but I'm going to do it anyway, and I'm not going to tell anybody that I'm doing that. It just seems so perverse.
Well, actually, one of the things we saw before the election, when we were still dreaming of a landslide, was that there was a kind of an emerging norm that no self-respecting American citizen would vote for Donald Trump, right? I mean, this was a deeply held belief on our part without any supporting evidence. Let's put it that way, right? So it's sort of the same thing, right? Rationally, you couldn't necessarily say that you knew that for sure, but there was this kind of disgust, this emergent disgust that was being widely expressed, and people don't want to be, they don't want it to be known that they're violating norms, that they pull the wings off of flies, or that they abuse puppies, right? And so, people didn't want to admit that. Yeah, well, I'm not going to tell you because I want to stay respectable in your eyes. Maybe they suspected the pollsters were lefties too, right? They were part of the fake news block. I don't know. And so they didn't tell the truth.
Well, we had the dream of a wave. And if you listen to Greg Pallas, the investigative reporter that focuses on elections and voting, he would say we would have had a blue wave if there hadn't been, over the last 2 years, a significant amount of voter theft and voter suppression in many of the key swing states and other states very, very similarly that happened to Stacey Abrams in Georgia when she ran for governor, that voters were just taken off the voter rolls that had African American last names or Asian last names or in Democratic neighborhoods, that sort of thing. So, but of course, voter suppression and theft is a whole nother discussion, but I just wanted to put that out, that there might have been a big blue wave if that hadn't been occurring.
Well, you know, there might have been. It's not an experiment that we would wish to rerun.
No.
but on the other hand, you know, more people voted than ever before. And in some key states, it's clear that even if there was voter suppression, it didn't prevent Biden from, well, it hasn't prevented Biden from looking like he's going to win in Georgia, you know, in Arizona, and certainly in Pennsylvania. So, and Wisconsin and Michigan as well.
Well, there was a clear message out there that we needed to come out very strong on the Democratic side to compensate for the gerrymandering and for the suppression. And so it seemed to have worked that more came out.
Up to a point, because if people have noticed, that down ticket didn't look as nearly
true.
As good for the Democrats, especially with state legislatures and, you know, this decennial redistricting coming up, that Republican state legislatures, by and large, will be able to draw district lines, you know, that favor them. And, you know, and that's the deep state right there. That's not, you know, the deep state is not in Washington. The deep state is in the states themselves, who can control the structure of the voting process. And in any event, that's not going to, you know, even if the redistricting favors the Republicans, it's not going to probably dissuade people from thinking there's a vast left-wing deep state conspiracy to undo them, right, and to strip away their power. I don't think that that's likely to make a difference, and it's not going to make a difference in the declining prospects of the white majority, but you know, in the ability of the white majority to assert its hegemony and supremacy over the society. And I think that's, you know, the demise of the Republican Party has been now predicted since at least 2000, right? That the vote for the Democrats would be very, very diverse and very large, and between liberals and whites and the various minorities, the Democrats would overwhelm the Republicans. But these things take a long time. You know, the change takes a demographic change does not happen overnight. And I think in this case, that's still going to happen, but it's not going to happen as soon as I think many predicted or hoped.
Now, you know that, because we've talked about this before, that one of my buttons is demonization. And it was interesting that Joe Biden in his speech the other night said, you know, quote, "For all those of you who voted for President Trump, I understand the disappointment tonight. I've lost a couple elections myself. But now let's give each other a chance. It's time to put away the harsh rhetoric, lower the temperature, and see each other again, listen to each other again." Do you think will Red America give others a chance or listen, or do you think the demonization that of the dueling realities between Democrats and Republicans are going to continue?
It's an excellent question, and I remember being told once that response means that one doesn't have an answer. You know, I'm skeptical that the demonization will end, and there are a couple of reasons. One of them depends, of course, on whether the Senate stays Republican or not, and we won't really know that for certain until January, which seems crazy to me, but that's Georgia. And the other one, and this is a little bit scarier, is that, you know, Donald Trump could run again in 2024. The limit is two terms. The limit is not consecutive
terms. Consecutive two terms. That's right.
So you know, he'll be, unless he leaves the country, you know, he'll be out there twittering all day and you know and egging people on the conditions that that gave rise to this divide have not changed. Joe Biden would like to change them. He would like to, you know, come let us reason together, as Lyndon Johnson used to say. But that depends on people saying, well, okay, you know, maybe we can work something out, compromise. That hasn't been the case in Congress now for how many years? For 6 years or more. When did the Republicans, 10 years, when the Republicans took over?
Right, 10 years.
Right, 10 years. And I don't see any prospect of that changing, even if the Democrats were to take, you know, to get 50 seats with Kamala Harris casting the deciding vote. It's hard to see how the Republicans would say, okay, well, you know, it's better for us to compromise. I don't see that happening.
Well, I'm afraid I don't either, and I know that Trump thrives on his rallies. They are what fuels him and makes him feel important, and I'm concerned that he will continue to be the president of Red America, and that it would be impossible to heal and reunite this country if he continues his rallies the day after he's out of office and says he'll run till 2024. Maybe the New York Attorney General has some ideas about for Donald Trump, but unless he's somehow accountable for the crimes that he's committed, I think he'll be the president of Red America.
You know, I'm just thinking here about, I know felons can't vote, but can felons run for public office?
There have been a few who've been elected from prison, I can tell you that.
Yeah, that's the thing. And, you know, so, and I think wasn't Lula in prison when he was re-elected, you know, I can't remember now. This, you know, there have been some cases, a case in Latin America, and I can't remember now which one.
Well, in Providence, Rhode Island, the mayor was re-elected from prison in the 80s, I think it was.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. Well, we know Joe Arpaio wanted to run again, but he was pardoned by Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, you know, but apparently he lost his primary.
Yes,
he
thank
did
goodness.
Run, and he lost in the primary, so... you know, so and as I said, right, I mean, Trump is basically sort of stimulating the existing chasm in this country, but Trump isn't the cause of it. You know, you can go back to the 1970s to see the origins of the conservative movement, which has been, you know, since hijacked in some ways. But in 1992, Pat Buchanan, again, who remembers Pat Buchanan? He was a speechwriter for Richard Nixon, and then he was I think he was on radio as well. He at the Republican convention, he launched the first volley of what we now call the culture wars, you know, and he basically said that the Democrats are the party, the godless party of depravity and anarchy, and you know, we can't allow that to stand. And you know, ever since, This has been part and parcel of the American political scene. Remember Newt Gingrich and the demonization of Bill Clinton, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, Trump is playing on the Republicans. You know, the red America. Red America just doesn't sound right. That sounds like a communist takeover.
It does, doesn't it? I'm sorry.
Yeah. It really doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work.
But you're right. The Republicans, right, he's playing on what you might call it's not exactly the race card, it's the everything card. But he's not the, you know, he didn't create it, and he's not going to end it. And
well,
so, yeah.
I want to talk a little bit more about demonization, but first, you're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org homepage, or listen to the show's podcasts at KSQD.org, Be Bold America's webpage.
And this program continues another 15 minutes. At 6 o'clock, we bring you Faith Matters. Your host will be Seth Shapiro. And he has a roundtable discussion with four faith leaders in the Santa Cruz area discussing election results and the implications of how the faith-based community is responding to that. So maybe they'll be talking about demons and angels and things like that as well here on K-Squid.
Today, our topic is a second civil war in our future? And we're speaking with Dr. Ronnie Lipschutz, author and UCSC Professor Emeritus of Politics and co-founder of the Sustainable Systems Research Foundation in Santa Cruz. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Now, Ronnie, before we get into the keep, stop, start, you know, what listeners can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing, I did want to talk about demonization a little bit more, and I will admit right up front that my list of demonizations are from my perspective as a Democrat. And I do have a friend who's a Republican that if she wasn't feeling well, she would have called in, and I might have gotten the Republican viewpoint of how Democrats demonize Republicans. But for me, I think the demonization, at least in my lifetime, started back with Reagan. The poor. There was the black woman driving around the pink Cadillac, who never existed. No reporter could find that meme, that person. And also the demonization of Democrats, you know, and today it's own the libs or better Russian than Democrat, which I saw on a T-shirt. And Democrats, we've already talked about Democrats drinking the blood of children or sex trafficking children. And then the demonization of universities and colleges, you know, their liberal brainwashing institutions. Or the demonization of federal government, you know, federal government is all incompetent and can't be trusted, and private corporations can do it better. And then the demonization of institutions such as our intelligence agencies or treaties or global agreements. And as the world is watching, I did read something that one person said in Europe, that when America votes, the world gets a president, and that president is head of that federal government and institutions. Then, of course, the demonization of socialism, which is going to be taking over America, or the demonization of individuals like George Soros, the demonization of the media, you know, they're all the enemy of the people, or the demonization of voting, you know, mail-in voting, all bad, or the demonization of science and scientists, the climate change is a hoax, or the demonization of truth, because if it doesn't fit a belief system, it's fake news. Then we've got the demonization of African-Americans, Hispanic women, and their sovereignty over their body. Or the demonization of Hollywood elites. You know, they're the elites, they're Democrats. They're also accused of being sex traffickers and of children and drinking their blood. And then, of course, the demonization of elites themselves. You know, and who are they? People that achieved the American dream or inherited their money or, as Trump has, a gold toilet. I think that's an elite. So I have this list of these of this demonization that I feel has just boxed armored Republicans from Democrats because of this is a message that they're getting consistently, not only from Donald Trump, but from the Republicans in Congress, Fox News, right-wing radio. What are your thoughts? And I spent a minute or two there to list that because putting it all in one place I thought was pretty powerful.
Yeah, it is. It is an amazing. I'm sure there's. You could add more. I wanted to say, about when America votes, when the U.S. sneezes, the world catches a cold.
That's another way to put it. Yes.
So,
yes.
You know. Well, you know. Again, to support the arguments about this sort of vast, faceless conspiracy, you have to have agents, right? There has to be someone who is pulling the strings. And what you've listed is essentially the roster of agents who are engaged in this vast conspiracy against white America and the so-called values and beliefs that it holds. And its dominance, right? Its control of the rules of the game, not just play. I like to make the distinction between the power to make the rules of the game and the power to play in a game.
Ah.
And I think it's a really important distinction. If you can get in there, you know, and get the legislature to make laws that favor you as a, you know, corporation or an interest group, you don't have to worry about competitors. It's much more difficult if you have to play the free market game. And again, this is the, you know, it's kind of that idea that, that somewhere there's this conspiracy that's remaking, you know, making new rules for life and society and all those kinds of things. I don't know where they are. I don't know who they are, but I have an idea that, you know, there are these people. And if you look at the list, right, this is sort of like people who have, who are somehow changing the rules that the right thinks applied in the 1950s when everything was right with the world.
In their mind, well, in their memory.
Yeah, obviously, but you know, the difference between memory and mind and sort of feeling now isn't all that great. The other thing is that there never was a golden age, right? This is a popular, you know, people talk about a golden age, but there's never been a golden age. It's just golden age in memory, mm-hmm. Or in sensibility or mm-hmm. something like that. You know, so this list is really a way of essentially saying, you know, there's this whole group of people, some with power, some with agency, and they're all, you know, coming to get you.
Yes.
They're coming after you. And again, you know, the creation of enemies is essential for any kind of, I don't know, political movement that fears, well, I won't say it's essential, but a political movement that fears that it's going to be eliminated or overrun or something like that needs an enemy to focus on. And it's much more difficult when you live with people all the time, when your neighbor may be a raving liberal, right?
Mm-hmm.
To say, my next door neighbor, you know, is an enemy mm-hmm. of the people out mm-hmm. to get me. So a lot of these are really vague. I mean, George Soros, you know, it's laughable, right?
Yes.
That he is somehow, you know, orchestrating all of this. But, you know, he's a convenient, I mean, he's an identifiable target. But if you look at the rest, there's no one there that's really specific. It's all these kind of vague people and institutions and you know, who knows what else. And because of you say, well, you know, tell me who exactly these people are. Who is the lady in the pink Cadillac? You know, point her to me, show me. People won't be able to do that. They don't have, you know, they won't be able to demonstrate to you that such people exist.
Well, moving to keep, stop,
yeah,
start.
Yeah.
So what should listeners, taking this whole discussion together, what should listeners keep doing, stop doing, and start doing?
Well, I think we should keep trying to achieve justice in the society and eliminate, to the extent possible, structural racism. And, you know, in the process of doing that, try to bring in some of the people who are so scared of that. It's important, I think, to keep talking, but it's also important not to expect that talking is necessarily going to resolve the differences. But I would say we need to keep trying to eliminate structural racism and discrimination. That's the most important thing.
And what should listeners stop doing?
I think we should stop allowing fears and beliefs to shape worldviews and social relations. And, you know, that's a very
Absolutely.
Difficult thing. It's very difficult because to the extent that people internalize fears and beliefs in their identities and their sort of sense of self, you know, giving them up is a radical act.
Well, it's also see fear is a real manipulation strategy. And,
oh, well,
you know, here we pride ourselves on being a home of the brave. And I thought, well, that went out a few decades ago. You know, people seem to be very afraid in this country of that list I read you.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, they are. But I'm just not sure that, you know, if we come and say, actually, you know, none of these exist, that's going to be convincing.
Right.
Right. And people will say, well, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. That's always a
A good one.
You know, a good one to say, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to stop, but I think, oh, I said that already, right? So we have to, you know, we have to do what we can to break out of these fears and beliefs, these pernicious fears and beliefs.
And then what should listeners start doing?
Well, I think we should almost certainly start to not legislate social discipline or rely on the courts for such decisions. Okay, so that's a roundabout way of saying that we have to engage in politics and not just simply rely on the courts or the legislatures to decide what's good for us. But I think also we have to start becoming a cooperative and collaborative society rather than a competitive one. I think that the high individualism that we've been socialized into since the 1970s is an extraordinarily pernicious thing. You know, instead of us, it's only I.
Yes.
And, you know, instead of we, and somehow we have to start to change that. And then the other thing I think is we have to start becoming a society driven not by the social hate of enemies, but by the social love of friends. And I mean, this sounds very
nice.
You know, very nice, right? I have here: hate requires one, love requires at least two. You can hate as an individual, but, you know, love involves other people. Mm. But love can be rejected, which is something we all fear. And so that's why fear or hate is much safer than love, because you never get rejected by hate, by people who hate you. You're already rejected.
Very deep. I like that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ronnie.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I also want to thank Howard Feldstein, the KSQD's program director, for being Be Bold America's program engineer today. And to give another huge thank you to Dr. Ronnie Lipschutz.
Whatever his name is.
Yeah, Ronnie Lipschutz, University of California, Santa Cruz, Professor Emeritus of Politics. Thank you, Ronnie.
Well, thank you for having me on, Jill.
Next time on Be Bold America, our interview guest will be Dr. Ruth Ben-Gayat. Dr. Ruth Ben-Gayat is an international award-winning author and political commentator on fascism, authoritarianism, leadership, authoritarian leadership, and propaganda. We'll be discussing her new book, Strong Men, Why Authoritarian Leaders Succeed and How They Fall. A timely talk since authoritarianism is consuming many countries that once had democracies. So please join me on Sunday, November 22nd at 5 p.m. to learn about Strong Men, Why Authoritarian Leaders Succeed and How They Fail. Want to listen to the show later? Find Be Bold America podcasts on KSQD's website. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for Faith Matters with Seth Shapiro. My name is Jill Cody, and thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.